This interview was brought to you by the Omega Center. The Omega Center is an online forum striving to facilitate a deepening of consciousness, conversation, and connection as we seek God in our scientific age. For the month of November, our emphasis has been to explore the question, what does a consciousness of love look like in an information culture? And then, obviously, the elections happened. For so many of us, this has been a deeply challenging time. No matter which side of the elections you were on, it's clear that we don't know each other as well as we thought we did. Maybe it's revealing that we haven't really been listening to each other. And it's also bringing up some big questions. How do we find unity when so much division is going on? How do we listen to each other? How do we help? How do we love our neighbor and protect the value of human dignity and our planet? I called Ilya Delio via Skype to discuss this month's Omega Center theme, as well as the topic of the election. Well, thank you, Ilya, for taking the time to get together and discuss some of these questions. I'm particularly excited for this conversation because we finally have gotten some questions from our subscribers. So I thought we would begin with a very pertinent question to what we're going through right now. This is a question from Mark. He says, Ilya wrote in The Depth of Love in a Shallow Culture the following, and this is from your blog. All of this to say the core crisis of our age is the crisis of love. We no longer know the truth of love or how to reason or the reason why love alone can transform our world into a new level of shared life. He says, the United States election has stirred up this core crisis of love in a powerful and urgent way. Do you have any specific advice for contemplative practitioners seeking to be a presence of love's depth in this fractured time post the U.S. elections?
Ah, that's a great question. That's a great question. Yes, I think, you know, I think the one thing is that this election, I think it took us by surprise in some ways, and so it swept us off our feet. And I think our tendency has been to react emotionally. It's almost been a fight or flight syndrome. You know, it's like when animals get, you know, into a situation where they seem threatened, there is sort of this emotional, you know, the deep emotional response to flee or to react. And so I think we don't want to stay there, you know, in that emotional reactive space. I like the term that Mark used, the contemplative praxis. That is the key. And we cannot lose sight of the depth dimension of our lives. And that's why I think it really, more than ever, I think especially in these times, our call is not to emotionally react, it's to go inward and harness the deeper energies of love within us and allow those energies to expand our vision, to expand our creativities, to expand our well-being that can help others in their fragile being. So I think the contemplative inwardness is critical right now. And so I might suggest, you know, we have to, and I would say as a contemplative practice, when we feel ourselves being emotionally driven by the news or by what's being said, I think we need to just take a deep breath and pause and step backwards, emotionally, psychologically, just step back and create a space, like a almost like a psychological space that will preserve our inner core of depth and beauty and love, and not allow that to be trampled by the superficial reactiveness of the moment. Because if we use up the depth of our being in just trying to survive, we will have nothing to create for a new future. And we know, you know, in terms of evolution, evolution never, never proceeds as a linear movement. It is always punctuated by periods of profound suffering, of profound death, of violence, of conflict. All these are part of evolution. So we can't lose sight that we are in evolution. But the power of that evolution is not might, and it is not about power alone. The power of evolution is love. That alone is what will transform us and move us to a higher level of shared existence, not a competition of existence, you know, where the weak will die out, or if you speak a different language, you'll be out, or, you know, if you look a certain way, you're out. That is not, in fact, that is not even how nature works, quite honestly. That's just brute force by a sheer will to power. And we know from the 20th century that a sheer will to power leads only to destruction. So now more than ever, I think those of us with, you know, the contemplative vision, with the desire to go inward, need to stay there. We need to go into ourselves and stay put, as Jesus said, you know, because that's our power. That is the power to transcend this moment and not to lose hope or vision for what we are being called to up ahead. Because we need to keep our sights on the future, not just simply the present moment in its very fragile, reactive state.
And what you touch upon with that, the need to go within, to go inward, that's such a sensitive topic for so many, because that's been the major critique of contemplation in many ways. Oh, well, you people are just about not doing anything in the world. And yet I sense the truth and the spaciousness of what you're saying. I can feel it in my body, particularly after a week of so much reactivity and divisiveness. It's all over Facebook. It's all over Twitter. And so what I sense that you're saying is that this pause, this going within, what it does is it roots us in the truth of who we are and the truth of our interconnectedness, so that we can listen to each other, so that we can move into creativity.
Exactly.
So how do we engage in right action, or how do we know when we're ready to move forward? You know, so that, what is the tipping point from that going within moment that then transforms into a pouring out?
I think life is always in that it's a dynamic flow between inner and outer, so that it's not just, you know, in this moment we're inner and then eventually we'll move out into action type thing. I do think we're talking about a contemplative being in the world where our beingness, our inwardness, is the very source of our action. So I do think that, and here's where I think we need, and this is why I think inwardness is so important. It is, in a sense, to attend to the moment. It requires a sharpening of our senses. How do we know when the right time comes, you know, to harness our energies together to create something new? And I think that is what discernment's about. I think it's, you know, and it's hard to just put this into words, because it's like when you are in that space of peace, of joy, of freedom. Freedom is the key word here. When you know you are free, when you are inspired in that freedom to transcend into a new level of love, and you share that with, you know, with others, and they're enkindled, I think a critical mass will be reached, quite honestly. I don't think we can plan the day or the hour or when this will occur. But I do think what is important is that this is not just it's not an individual journey that we're on. I think what we need more and more is to realize our collective being, that we are in this together. I was sharing today with my project manager, you know, in this remodeling project. And, you know, he's a He's worked since he's 17. He, you know, has his own business and general contractor. You know, he's very worried. He's from Puerto Rico and his wife's from Colombia. And, you know, we were talking about the state of affairs, you know, in our new political situation. And I said, you know, there's no longer a sense of a we. We are in this together. You know, do not feel alone or isolated. And, you know, he said, yeah. I said, you know, that's good to hear that, you know, there's no one who's left out of this loop. But, you know, I think we do need certain people. We need visionaries, and we need creative visionaries. We need imagination. If not this political situation, what do we imagine? Because the imagination is then what kindles our action. You know, we move toward that. I do think the whole reign of God language in the Gospels is about imagination. Can you imagine, you know, what this could be? So I think God is always asking us to imagine something ahead and then to move toward it. And life is about the moving toward. And I think it would be unwise of us to think that we're going to gain, you know, we're going to achieve something. But the thing is, right now, the whole trajectory just seems so dissonant, because people are sort of on this individual, you know, I'm going to take what I can and preserve myself, and, you know, because I'm not sure what's going to happen. And we can't lose sight that we are a collective. We are a collective whole. We are a whole on. We really are. That's our cosmic natural root. And I think contemplation, anyone who goes into the center of being knows oneself as part of everyone else. You know, in other words, you know yourself to be part of the other. That's what the deeper sense, that's what contemplation brings us to in its deeper root. And we need that consciousness of being together. It is really, you know, I always think of Jesus' prayer of the Our Father. Who is the Our here? It's not like, you know, me and God, we're going to work this out together. You know, it's a collective, it's a consciousness. I think that's what the Gospels are about, a consciousness of belonging to a whole. And so I would say, don't lose sleep and don't lose your peace over this present moment, because we need to go more deeply into this power of love energy at the heart of this beingness itself. And I think we need to be discerning about what are we being called to, you know, because we know that if we spend all our energies here, you know, trying to right the wrong, so to speak, we are not attentive to what the Spirit may be drawing us to on a whole new level. So do not lose your imagination. Do not lose the power of creativity. And when the right time comes, you know, just share it. I think just share. And, you know, when you share, others will be there. Because everyone, what I find is once I begin to share, people come up and they say, you know, you're putting words in what I have felt for so long. We're already one. That's what we find out. We're already one. But it takes one person to begin to name it, you know, that the experience, and others, then it's like light bulbs go on. And they're, I'm with you. You know, we're in this together. And I think when the critical masses reach, a new threshold will emerge.
So that all feels very Teilhardian, right? Because Teilhard talked about the essential force of suffering, the ways in which suffering can unify us and bring us together. But he doesn't diminish that the suffering is real.
Absolutely.
You know, he clearly was somebody who suffered greatly in his life. So this was not the conjectures of somebody who was sitting up in an ivory tower, you know, twiddling his thumbs. This was somebody who had been out in the fields of war as a stretcher bearer, somebody who had been...
And writing from those trenches.
Yeah, writing from the midst of war itself. Somebody who had been isolated and ignored and silenced by his own community. And so I think, you know, it's very easy for us to kind of get into this very reactive place. And what I sense that you're saying is that that turning inward roots us deeply into that connection to the whole, so that we recognize that there are those among us who have been marginalized, who have been oppressed, who have been hurt, and that we can together begin to imagine a new future with creativity, rather than just letting the pendulum of reactivity swing back and forth.
Right.
There's a real important step there that I don't want to skip over, which is the acknowledgement of pain and suffering and trauma and how these things can be passed generationally. So what is our relationship toward pain? How do we acknowledge the pain of each other, hold it without becoming identified with it?
Mm-hmm. Well, I do think, I mean, you know, I think it would be naive of us to think that any crossing over into a new level of existence that could actually be more unified or of higher consciousness would be without pain or suffering, would be extremely naive of us. And I think, truthfully, I go back to the gospel because I think the gospels exemplify this, you know, and it's really, in a sense, it takes everything we have and everything we are to enter into something new. And I think, you know, several things. One is, I think sometimes there's a suffering in suffering. It's not suffering alone. I mean, we suffer all from many, many different ways all the time, emotionally, psychologically, spiritually, physically. But I think there's a way of, you can either cope with suffering and accept it, you know, it's the fragility of life, and then it causes us to reevaluate or reorient our priorities. But the suffering within suffering is the feeling of abandonment, the feeling of being alone, the feeling of not being understood at all.
Hopelessness. Definitely.
Hopelessness, isolation, you know, and that's the suffering, I think, that concerns us, because that suffering leads to a sense of not just disillusionment, but a real disconnectedness, like no one really knows my pain. And that feeling of just being abandoned. And we abandon ourselves in that. But the truth is, I think we need to, part of it is I do think we try to control life. You know, we want to even control our pain, you know, and we want to sort of, you know, be the ones who tell ourselves, okay, it's enough pain. You know, I don't want any more pain. I don't want any more suffering.
Done with that.
I do think we have to, life will always have pain and suffering and death. That is life. It is limited. In other words, it's contingent. It is always dependent on, you know, other life. And so I do think this is why God, you know, or divinity or absolute love becomes really important, because even Omega, if we talk about Omega as love, there's an absolute love at the center of our lives that knows our pain even before we're conscious of it. You know, and to recognize that that love is the fidelity of God, that, yes, okay, it's falling apart, really. I mean, it's like I can't take anymore. And yet that love is like, I am with you. You know, I am your future. And to believe in that love means we are not alone. There is one other, you know, who is with us and who will suffer, in a sense, with us and for us. And you know, I always think of the martyrdom account of Felicity and Perpetua. I don't know if you studied that, but the early church.
That was a good time.
Yeah, so, you know, I think of those young women going into the Colosseum, or even that whole thing, like, you know, Christians, you know, because they just identified themselves as Christian, you know, I mean, you know, really, literally risking their lives. And, you know, she's in childbirth and she's about to give birth. And, you know, the soldier says, you know, you're screaming in agony now. I mean, what are you going to do when the lions maul you? And she says, you know, now I suffer, but then there will be one other who suffers in me. There is something about, you know, how badly do we want a new world? That's really the question. You know, how much do we really, really want this? Because the fact is, I think we all want it on our terms. And our terms are, I like my life. I really don't want to, you know, upset it too much. And really, well, okay, here's the thing. If you don't want to upset it too much, then you will get, a lot of you won't achieve, we won't achieve what we really hope for. I think, it's the same thing. Like, unless a grain of wheat falls to the ground and dies, it remains a single grain. Do we really want an abundant harvest of life? Or do we want to just sort of like, just maybe get beyond this little political faux pas and, a nicer day? I find people are just very comfortable. I just wrote my blog for the month of December, again, on consumerism, because I think consumerism plays a huge, huge role in deadening our imagination, our creativity, our trust power, our hope power. It's like, I think I'll just go to the mall and lose myself. And I love shopping. Don't get me wrong.
Retail therapy.
It is. It's retail therapy. Go and watch, look at beautiful things. And, but on the other hand, if we spent half that amount of time caring for the poor, caring for the earth, just reaching out in our own communities, who's lonely? Who is in pain? Do we even know who's in pain in our midst? I think families can live together and not even know who's suffering, in their own household. I've seen it in communities, sisters or brothers going, yeah, we're community. And they have no idea that the person they're living next door is like going through serious depression or, is alcoholic because they feel completely abandoned. We don't even know one another, sufficiently to know what we're suffering. And this is a very Western modern phenomenon. This was not really, you wouldn't find this in the primal religions or tribal religions, where the community was first. You belong to the community, which included the earth and the sun and the stars. And so another's pain was our pain, another's suffering is our suffering. I think there are even tribes in Africa today, and other parts of the world where it would be unthinkable not to tend to your community member first before doing anything else. If anyone is in need, you go to them first. But it's a Western thinking. It's a Western phenomenon. Independent, the autonomous self. It's on my terms, on my time. I'll control it at my will. Well, fine. Okay, do it. It'll go nowhere. And it's just fragmenting us over and over again. So we need to find new, I've always thought religious life, truthfully, has maybe the seeds of what we could hope for. But I don't even think religious life, as it's grown up no longer, I don't think that works either. But I think we need to reformulate religious life as a life of living together, shared values, shared vision, shared earth, and care for one another. As one writer said, only care for another human person humanizes us. What humanizes us? That's our question.
That's so profound. I've been thinking a lot about the role of memory and how our memory has this power to impact how we see things, how we see reality, and how we see ourselves. And we have our finite memory, which is the memory that most of us operate with, which is that I was born, and then this is my story, and these are the wounds I've received, and here's my particular bent, my particularity. But it strikes me that one of the roles that religion held for so long that is somewhat lost now, it's lost this, is the capacity to remember, so bring back the members together into a memory, a larger knowing, a larger narrative.
Yeah.
So it was like in these rituals, what was concretized was you are older than this. You come from an older evolution. You didn't just happen here. You were a part of something that's been forming itself for so long. And so, I think about that. So like, what is the impact of how we understand memory? And as we've lost our connection to religion, that religare, rebind, or is that correct? Is that rebinding? We've lost that capacity to bind ourselves to one another and remember. What will step in now to bring that older memory? And I was actually watching YouTube the other day. I don't know how I I don't know, out of despair, like just started watching random videos. And somehow, probably from a thread of somebody else, I connected with this video on DNA, the story of DNA. And it was a little hokey. It was set up. It was this group of people, and you know, they talked about their biases and which ethnicities they preferred or didn't prefer. And of course, it was all a great setup, because as they did their DNA testing, it was revealed that, oh, they came from those very countries that they were prejudiced against, you know? But I thought about this, and I thought, you know, perhaps science really is going to be an essential part of religion as we move forward. You know, it is the only language to date, right now, that mm-hmm. can help us connect to the most ancient memory, you know,
yeah.
part of evolution, that we really are in mm-hmm. this together.
Yeah, mitochondrial DNA, or what do they call that? Mitochondrial Eve. You know, we all have it. We all share the same genetic mitochondrial DNA. Yeah, I love the idea of memory, you know, because, and as you said, to remember is to be remembered too, mm-hmm. you know. Remember to the past, remember to one another as we're drawing to consciousness, you know, what has gone before us. And yet we're also being remembered to the future. You know, as we remember, then that being bound together, you know, is towards something new. You know, that we remember not so we live in the past, we remember, you know, in order to create the future. And I think without memory, we have nothing, in a sense, to grow out from, you know, and grow into. So there is a power to memory. It is about consciousness and that mysterious depth of consciousness, that there's something deep within us. And I do think that this memory, and in terms of religion, there's something there, you know, that there's something deep, deep within us. There's archetypal you know, symbols of religion within us, that, you know, it, and we're longing to be bound to remember, to be remembered, you know, to our deep, deep roots, but we can't find them in our modern age. And so we substitute all sorts of idols and things for those roots. And they're unfulfilling. They're very fragmented. They're very thin. And we're just so longing, deeply longing. And I think, you know, it's that, it, again, that being remembered is in that power of the narrative of God, that God is, you know, doing new things in our midst. So even, you know, even the ritual of the Catholic Mass, you know, while I, you know, could see updating it in terms of, you know, new cosmology, but the sacraments and the symbols, you know, all are very, very powerful in drawing together. If we had a deep consciousness of what we are being called to in those rituals, in that sacramentalizing of our lives in this creation, it is extremely powerful. You know, we are being remembered to Jesus. Like, that life of Jesus now is our life. And that life now is the life we are empowered with as we go forth into the world, so that we now are that Jesus in the world. That's the whole thing. And that's why to be a Christian and to live sort of mediocre or half-hearted is sort of a lie. Like, you can't go and be part of this quantum entangled Eucharist and then go out and say, I don't really like these people, or I don't like the, you know, I don't want to be associated with these people, or if you're, you know, if you're sick, I don't have no time for you, or I'm not, you know. We can't exclude people and say that we're Christian. So I would say we need really a revamping of what we mean by our religious, you know, longings and what we're committing ourselves to. We need a greater test on authenticity, because we're lacking authenticity of the power of religion today. But that power has not gone away. It's deep within us, deep in our midst. And I think we long to be remembered to it again. And we need to find a new remembering.
one of the questions that somebody asked, or it wasn't really so much a question, but he posted a comment. This is from Endel. It speaks to this idea of remembering. How do we come together and how do we form community? And he kind of shared that. He says, you know, as I'm finding evidence throughout the Omega Center, he says, these posts overflow with very rich content. So good for us. He says, but catching my eye in particular are the paradoxical perils of separation and loneliness increasingly present in an ever greater interconnected technological environment. So as our technology is becoming more connected, mm-hmm. you know, we're becoming more lonely.
Mm-hmm.
He says, as the new sphere, this is a Teilhardian term, new sphere, complexifies on its surface, the challenge continues to be, how do we find connection with that deep center-to-center personal relationship whereby mm-hmm. the heart of one person finds itself centered in mm-hmm. another? He says, you know, as he's reading this blog, he says one of the things that he's trying out is, he says that I've reached out to a group of dear friends connected in local community to explore this content together as an mm-hmm. Omega Center discussion group. With hope and faith, this will provide both an inside and outside path as we share further what entanglements co-created here online with you. So I think about that, you know, that we have so many options, so many creative ways that we can reach out. You know, perhaps thinking about belonging to a church is an increasingly antiquated idea for those of us in my generation. But that we still have a responsibility to connect, to reach out, and we can find common ways of connecting and remembering, as you said, even over topics like, hey, start an Omega Center discussion group or get together and have a big meal. So,
I think that's how church happens. You know, I mean, it's where you gather together. You gather with similar longings and a desire to be part of a whole, you know? And that whole, I mean, institutionally we're saying God is at the center of that whole. That's what we're saying. You know, love is at the center of that whole. There's a power drawing us. And I think that gathering together is to give voice and meaning to that power. You know, what is that is drawing us together? And we know that, you know, community is probably our most natural. We know that when we are in life-giving community, we are made for relationship, you know. And so when we know we're in the community that gives us life, we are most truly ourselves. We are at our freest. We are at our most creative, you know, because we spend most of our time looking for that relationship where we can really love, be loved, and therefore be ourselves and grow into that fullness that God is creating us to be.
But loving and being ourselves requires us to, first of all, I think, accept our own imperfection so that we can then accept the imperfection of others.
Absolutely.
You know? It's like this is part of where I feel a great level of impasse today, this week, with all this reactivity. It's that there's almost no room for human error. And is not error the only way? Are not mistakes the critical way by which evolution moves forward?
Yeah, and I would say, you know, and I think we have to stop trying to control everything.
Yeah.
We insist on trying to control it. And for some reasons, it is beyond our control. You know, again, it's knowing when the right time comes to let go, you know, and to engage new structures of relationship. The operative word is relationship, and what happens is we get absorbed in the vortex of the emotional lack of control. You know, this didn't go my way. You know, it didn't happen the way I expected it to. What am I going to do? And so we spent all our time wondering how are we going to get back in control of what we thought was supposed to happen, rather than, okay, this happened, and I think it's more like chaos theory. Okay, the old order I thought I had some sense over is breaking down, but every order that is breaking down, something new is happening. What's the strange attractor? You know, that's the question. What's the strange attractor here? What's the silent, hidden basin of attraction that's actually quietly at work through all this disorder? And can we attend to that strange attractor and allow that to pull us into new directions of creativity and love and relationships and imagination? You know, and the operative word is hope, not to lose hope. Hope always stretches forth and reaches out toward the incomprehensible, that which cannot be grasped. You know, and when we live in hope, we live with an unbounded zest for life. And I think, you know, that's Teilhard's term, not to lose a zest for life. And, you know, if we insist on controlling everything, we not only not have zest, but we're barely surviving, you know, from one day to the next. You know, and I know we talked about this the last time, but it is really just trying to get from point A to point B, when in fact we are called to be, you know, on a more like not how are we going to survive this? Do we have enough gas for the trip? But, you know, more like we're on a high speed, you know, we're on a high speed train or we're on a high speed great adventure ride, you know, and we're being let go. And, you know, I think we need to keep our sights wide open, but not to lose sense of personhood. I think this is something we can all practice. In our technologically, techno-saturated age, every available moment we have to love another person, in other words, to say hello, to see their good, to just attend to them, just to say, hey, you know, how you doing? You know, just to recognize them, just to recognize someone else is the beginning of a relational world. When we're walking around with earbuds in our ears, our phones in our faces, our heads down, lowered, you know, like the don't bother me, I can't cope type thing, we cut ourselves off, you know. So I think we must find and make every way possible for people and creaturely relatedness.
Well, I appreciate your time and your perspective on all of this in the midst of what has obviously been such a tremendously turbulent week for so many. Thank you, Ilya.
My pleasure. You know, this is, I think, again, we're in this together. So do not despair. Do not lose hope. Life is being born up ahead. You know, be where life is.
For more information on the Omega Center, be sure to visit our website, omegacenter.info. Join us as we continue to explore new topics each month on our blog, and where you can also become a subscriber so that you can ask Ilya questions that will be answered in these interviews and access to exclusive content. On behalf of the Omega Center, thank you for listening.